Look at this crowd. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the South Dixie Group. I haven't found necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981. And by the grace of God, and I'm grateful to be here. And I love this group. Never been here before, but I got to tell you something. I'm privileged, and I'm excited being here on your fourth anniversary of this group. And I got to tell you why. First of all, you're all young and good looking. Look at this. What is the average age here? 10? What, I mean, how old are you guys? Do you guys even drive? I mean, there's one. How did you even grow that beard? You know, I mean, you guys are like. I'm looking at you guys. My socks are older than you. I'm wearing socks older than most of you guys. I've been around for a long. You can tell by looking at me. I've been somewhere for a long time. My youngest daughter is 30 years old. I got a son, 42 years. I got four kids and six grandkids. And yes, is that for me? Six grandkids, and I've been around. You know, as you can tell, I've been sober for a little over 35 years, and it's great to be here. And I don't know, can you hear me in the back? I'm going to talk a little loud because I see it's a big room. And you guys really are, I love young people in AA. I love old people. I just love people in AA. I love people, actually. You don't even have to have a chip in your pocket to be my friend. I love a lot of people and never used to be that way. And we'll talk a little bit about that. They say AA is like a giant toolbox. There's a wrench to fit every nut that walks through the door. And I don't know whether I'll be your wrench tonight, but I'm going to talk a little bit about my deal. And this is just me. This is just my opinion. It's just me. You don't have to go along with it. You don't have to worry about it. You know, you can get. You're free to get a resentment about. I'm not here to make people happy. You know, you can. I'm here to, you know, to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. So, you know, you just remember, if you get upset about something I said, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. So, if you get pissed off, you'll walk out of here and you'll say, I can't believe that son of a bitch. Who the hell invited him? I hate that son. Who the hell does he think he is? That's a bunch of bullshit. And you'll either drink or get over it. And if you get over it, it'll be because you do some sort of four-step, some sort of inventory, or you'll pray about it, or you'll talk to your sponsor. And a week down the road, after you've thought about me for every night for the next week, because I touched something in you that's fucked up, you know what I mean? The same thing, I've touched in you something that has been driving you crazy about the world and all these people in the world that has caused you all such problems all your life, but I said it, so you're blaming me and you don't like me, and somehow, some way, you'll either drink over it, or you'll have a resentment over it, or you'll continue to be angry over it, or you'll pray to God, and you'll talk to your sponsor, and you'll do an inventory, and you'll sit down, and you'll say, "Now, you know, that son of a bitch, that asshole, he was right. He was right." And then 6 years from now, you'll come up to me and say, "You know, I used to hate you, but now I love you." And all of a sudden, something that's been bothering you about me and other people for the last 10 years and getting you in trouble, all of a sudden it'll be gone. And all those people that said the things and did the things like me, they won't bother you anymore, and you'll just get one step closer to not being pissed off all the time. And that's how we grow in here. We grow in here by analyzing resentments and analyzing crap that happens in this world, because your whole sobriety is about you're going to be okay as long as the world's okay. You might as well start drinking now. The world ain't going to be okay. It's not here to help you out. It's here to kill you out there. Out there, it's just about movies and TV and people that are telling you you're insufficient and you're a piece of shit and you're never going to be okay. And that's why you wake up in the morning and say, should I go to work or just blow my fucking brains out? And that's the real alcoholism, because here's the problem. I'm going to talk a little bit about drinking, you know. And let me tell you what the problem is. I drank for 15 years. I am an alcoholic. Did I mention that? If I didn't, I am an alcoholic. I drank 15 years but you understand, I've been sober for 35 years. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm just trying to explain something to you. They say when you come to AA, your story will change. I mean, you know, some of you guys have been sober for years, sometimes 2 years, sometimes 3 years, sometimes 6 months, whatever it is. However long you're sober, you know that you have your whole attitude. What did Dr. Young say? Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which are the driving. Remember that word, driving. Forces of these men's lives are shifted over to one side. They become dominated by a whole new set of ideas, emotions, and attitudes. You know, remember, that's what, you know, what happens in here is, as time goes on, your whole personality, you have a psychic change, it changes. And it continues to change. It's dynamic. It changes. The people here who are sober like 8 months think completely differently about their life and things than they thought 8 months ago. people here who have 10 years think completely differently than they thought 5 years ago. I've got 35 years. I think completely differently than I thought when I had 25 years, when I had 15 years, when I had 5 years. And so the fact of the matter is that I've been dealing with I never dealt with the disease. None of us deal with the disease when we're drinking. You deal with something called drunk. Drunk is different than disease. Drinking is a symptom of the disease. It's a hell of a symptom. I mean, they don't arrest you for driving while feeling sorry for yourself. They arrest you for driving. Well, feeling sorry for yourself is more closer to the disease than the drinking. The drinking is what I use so I wouldn't feel sorry for myself. The drinking, I drank because no woman, no car, no suit of clothes, no job, no pair of jeans, no nothing ever worked quite as well or quite as fast as just a few drinks. Men and women, and if it did for you what it did for me, you'd drink too. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, irritable, and discontent unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that's why I drank. And if alcohol did for me today what it did for me 35 years ago, I'd still be drinking it. But alcohol stopped working for me, and so I don't drink. But you know something? All those other things, the women, the sex, the porn, you know, the money, the cars, the job, all the stuff out there, you know, that's saying to me that I'll never amount to anything. You know what my problem was? I was a nothing. Didn't matter that I was a lawyer, I was division chief in the state's attorney's office, I was a prosecutor. Didn't matter all that stuff. Whatever vanity stuff that I gathered around me, none of that stuff mattered. I knew when it came right down to it, I was a nothing. I was always going to be a nothing. I was never going to be anything but a nothing. I used to put something in my body, it turned me into an almost. When you're a nothing, almost is top of the world. And that's why you wake up and that's why you're showering, you're in the shower and you're sober and you hear that voice. I don't know, maybe you guys don't have the kind of alcoholism I have. The real alcoholism where you hear that voice and it tells you you're a piece of shit. You might as well kill yourself. You might as well offer yourself. You know, you're never going to be okay. What the hell is wrong with you? When are you going to be okay? You're such an idiot. And you turn around in the shower to see who's saying that crap to you, and you're the only one in the shower. And that's where the alcoholism really starts. So what you have to understand is, although I'm going to talk a little bit about drinking, I've been dealing with alcohol. I stopped drinking 35 years ago. And so I've been an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic before I started drinking. I was an alcoholic during the drinking. I've been an alcoholic after the drinking. I've been dealing with the dis-ease of alcoholism. So you have to understand, when you've been dealing day in, day out, through the vagaries of life, through all the crap that's going on, all the people, you know, and you know how alcoholics are. You know, we sit around and all we do is worry about, well, not you. I can understand I used to say, like, we worry about what other people, a whole life attuned to worrying about what other people think about you. An entire life where the most important thing in your life is worrying about what other people think about you or what they're going to think about you. You know, a whole life focusing on what you think other people think about you. Imagining what people think about you, what they're going to think about you if they find out this, if they find out that, if that happens. And then saying things to yourself like, I don't give a shit what other people think about me. That's what alcoholics do. They tell themselves lies. I'm a rationalizer. I tell myself rational lies. I'll say to myself over and over again, I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit what other people think about me. I'll say it out loud. I'll be in a bar. I'll say, I don't give a shit what other people think about me. I don't give a crap what they think about me. But what you ultimately learn is people that don't give a crap what other people think about them never say or think, I don't give a crap what other people think about me. They say things like pass the ketchup, but they don't say that shit. You know what I mean? The only people that says that over and over to themselves that they don't care about what other people think about me is people that live their entire lives worrying about what other people think about them. And that's a crappy situation if you're involved in that. And you want to know something? I do that obsessively. I do that addictively. You can stop the drinking. You can't stop the thinking. You know why I do that? Because I'm driven to do that. Because the real disease centers in the fact that I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm driven. There's the word again. Driven. And listen, don't blame me. If you don't like this, call up New York, because this stuff is right out of the book. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, 100 forms of fear. That means if you know 5, you got 95 that you don't even know about. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. I step on the toes of others. They retaliate, usually without provocation. I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. But in the end, we find that we've made decisions based upon self, driven to make decisions. We don't even know why we're doing it. We're the one, we do the stupid-ass things. Carl Menninger wrote a book in 1935. He said, Man Against Himself. In the chapter on alcoholics, he said, alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. Given any set of circumstances, all the money in the world, all anything, if you're an alcoholic, you will somehow destroy yourself. Either physically, mentally, spiritually, you will destroy yourself. And that's the disease I've been dealing with for 35, without the booze. Because, you know, once the booze starts, somewhere along the line, I don't know when it happened to you. I'm not quite sure. I can't remember when it happened to me. Somewhere along the line, after you stop drinking, after the initial incredible excitement is over about not drinking, after the obsession is gone, where you're thinking, oh, there's another day I'm not drinking, you know, where you're thinking about all the drinking, where all of a sudden it's left and you're not drinking, somewhere along the line, somewhere in the future, if it happens, hasn't happened to you, it's going to happen to you. It's going to be you're going to have your 3 o'clock in the morning with the fear. And there's no fear like sober fear. You're going to be worried about the money. You're going to be worried about the girl. You're going to be worried about the guy. You're going to be worried about whatever. There's going to be something. Your life is over. It's a horrible situation. And you know something? You know you can't drink, but you know, maybe putting a bullet in your head is a possibility. You're not going to. That's actually a sign of wellness. It's actually a sign. You know, it's crazy that you worry about that you're going to kill yourself. But the truth is, when you start saying, when things get so painful, you know the way we get a new perspective, it says in the book? Did somebody tell you that if you come today, everything's going to be okay, you're never going to have a problem? I hope they didn't tell you that, you know, because you might think that's true. You know what it says in the big book, in the 12 and 12, in chapter 7, it says the way we get a new perspective, and this is all about getting, is unbelievably painful. Not even painful, unbelievably painful. You know, 100 forms of humiliation. In the final crushing of our self-sufficiency, we learn the value of suffering. Doesn't that sound like, hey, welcome to A. You're going to learn the value of suffering. Somewhere along the line, if it happens to happen to you, it's going to happen to you. You're going to be in such pain at 3 o'clock in the morning, and your sponsor's not going to be there, and nobody's going to be there, and you're just going to have to try to figure out how to make it to the next day, and you know it's going to be a horror story. Somewhere along the line, you're going to say this. Now I know why I drank. You're going to say, now I know why I drank. I'm not drinking, but I'm crazy. I sponsored a guy named Tommy. And Tommy was a co-prosecutor for me. We were division chiefs in the Dade County State's Attorney's Office. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. He was a jock in college, a sharp guy. He used to handle major cases. We used to handle major cases down there. And he was a drinking buddy of mine. And I got sober, and 3 years later, I got a call from Tommy, and he was sleeping on a probation officer's floor. He had been divorced from his wife. He was wearing the same pair of jeans for last week, the same shirt for last week. He allowed his beard to grow down to here. His hair had grown, and he had called me up. He was supposed to be in court, and he couldn't make it to court, and he was doing coke and booze and everything you could possibly imagine. And he wanted to kill himself. He had like a shotgun in his mouth. And I said, Tommy, I'll be right over. And I went and I got Tommy. And I took him to his first AA meeting. And he loved it. He loved it. And the next day, he shaved. He cut his hair. You know, I think he got a crew cut or something. You know what I mean? He got on the new pants, the new shirt. He looked like the old Tommy. He looked like he was doing great. Great. He was going to meetings like crazy. A month later, he calls me up on the phone. I sponsored Tommy for the first 3 years. Months later, he calls me up on the phone. He's driving somewhere in Tampa. He was doing great. He loved AA. And he said to me, he said, Russell, he says, I said, what, Tom? He says, I think I have to leave AA. And I said, what are you talking about, Tommy? He says, I think I have to leave AA. He says, what do you mean? He says, well, you know, I'm not drinking. I haven't had a drink in a month. I said, I know that, Tommy. He says, let me tell you something. I think I'm crazy. He had had these thoughts, you know what I mean? These crazy-ass, self-destructive, crazy-ass thoughts. He said, I think I'm just crazy. I haven't had a drink. I'm nuts. I said, I think I have to leave. He says, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I think I'm crazy. I said, Tommy, he says, what? I said, listen. I said, what? He says, you can be both. He said, really? I said, absolutely. You can stop the drinking, but how are you going to stop the thinking? So understand, for 35 years, without the booze, I've been dealing with the bullshit. I've been dealing with those stupid people. You know what I mean? You know, one of the things that you're given as an alcoholic is the incredible discernment to recognize assholes. Is that true? How many people here were bar drinkers? I mean, I was a lounge lizard from way back. You know, I wanted what she had. I was willing to go to any length to get what I wanted, you know, to get that deal. And so I'm sitting there in a bar with my buddy, and you can, like, see through people. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting there with my buddy, and I look over at the door. It's all the way over the door like that. That maybe it's like 200 feet away. And I see some guy I've never even seen before. And he's walking in with some good-looking gal. I look at him. He looks at me. I turn to my buddy. I said, look at that asshole. You just know you don't like him. You know, he's a jerk, you know, and everything like that. You get feelings about people, you know, when you're an alcoholic. So the bottom line is, I've been dealing with the dis-ease of alcoholism, dealing with those thoughts and those imaginations and what's happening and how I feel and why do I feel this way and when am I going to feel better and what's wrong and everything like that. And you know, the spiritual axiom is whenever you disturb, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. Well, my spiritual axiom is whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you, with you, with you. There's always something. Let me tell you something. I can pin it on somebody. There's always somebody or something going on in my life that if they only changed, everything would be okay. And them sons of bitches aren't changing. And I don't know how to change them. So all I can do is think in my mind how I wish they were dead. And you know, when you walk around thinking about offing people and killing people and wishing people were dead and stuff like that, it doesn't really lead to a happy and productive life. You know, you don't get rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence. You don't experience much of heaven. None of that stuff sort of happens because you're sober, but you're just sort of shitty. You know, and it doesn't really feel good. So I've been dealing with working on that, and I got married. I've been married for 35 years, so I've had a marriage. I've had children, grandchildren, a law practice, all that sort of stuff. I mean, I'm out there in the world doing this stuff. You know what I'm talking about? So that's the stuff I've been dealing with for 35 years. You know, I didn't deal with the booze. I dealt with the booze for 15 years, 35 years on a daily basis. So you know what So can you imagine what I want to talk about is the disease of alcoholism. I want to talk about what you're dealing with right now. I know for identification purposes, I got to talk a little bit about booze and tell you about that, but it ain't going to be a drunk log. It's going to be about how not thinking suicidal thoughts and thinking about what a piece of shit you are, if you're interested in that. Just in case you're interested in that. It's going to be talking about the real disease of alcoholism. You know, I think the first time, you know, the first, I think you spend the first, well, you, I don't want to act like you, like I've graduated or not, because I haven't. But I think you spend a long time, maybe the first 20 years, just trying to figure out what the disease is. I mean, I think the first 5 years is like, what the fuck is wrong with me? The second 5 years is like, when is this fucking thing going to go away? You know what I mean? The third 5 years is, I don't know what the hell's going on. You know what I mean? I mean, it just takes a long time to try to get a handle, because every time you think you're going somewhere, all of a sudden something happens and it sets you back again. And it seems there's always more growth. There's always more stuff going on. And so, I, what happens is I start thinking, you see a lot of stuff in retrospect, in the rear view mirror. A lot of stuff I see now about my life at 35 years when I was a kid and a child and stuff like that, that I never saw when I walked in here. And the first one of the things I talk about when I talk about what is alcoholism like, the patterns I see in my life, is when I was about 15 years old, I discovered something called the Playboy magazine. Now, I don't know anything about Playboy now. I haven't looked at it in years or anything like that, and I think they've changed it. But back then, they had nude pictures of women, good-looking women. And I was 15 years old, and I opened up that Playboy magazine. And guys, let me tell you something. I knew immediately what would fix me. I knew immediately. Yeah, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. I knew immediately what would fix me. If I had one of them bunny things that adored me, and I chased that shit for 10 years, 10, 15, I chased that stuff. You know, I knew that that was the answer. And in order to get one of those things, you need, you know, a car. You need to be good looking. You need to be a certain way. You need to have a lot of accoutrements, especially when you're a piece of shit. Not that I'm a piece of shit. Not that I'm a piece of shit, because I'm the greatest freaking thing in the world. I am unbelievable. You don't appreciate. You don't know how smart and wonderful I am. In between the times, I think I'm a piece of shit. You know, you got that thing going. You're wonderful. You're great. You're better than anybody. But something in your mind says you're a piece of crap, and you know, you got that those two sort of thoughts. I mean, it's like a split. Some guy said, I think you have a split personality. I said, I wish I could get it down to two. I'd be okay. You know, I mean, you got that thing going on. These voices in your mind. One voice says you're the greatest. You're the best. They don't understand. You're better than all of them. One voice says, raise your hand. You know the answer. The other voice says, don't raise your hand. What if you're wrong? They'll think you're stupid, you know. One voice says, ask this question because you don't know. It's a good question. The other voice says, don't raise your hand because if you ask the question, they're going to think you're stupid. I mean, you got all this stuff going on that paralyzes you with fear of people, although I don't really give a shit what people think about me, you know what I mean? But you're just totally confused, and life is just difficult. It's just difficult. And so I got this magazine, and one of the things that happens if you're an alcoholic is you're scared of people. And you've got an inner feeling that you're not good enough. You got a feeling. Let me tell you something. I was a fast drinker. You know, as a matter of fact, when I came today, my buddy said to me, he says, "Well, we didn't think you drank that much, but boy, you drank fast," because I wanted to get away from feeling the way I felt fast. I wanted to get away from feeling fear of whether they liked me or not fast. I wanted to get away of fear of being inadequate fast. I wanted to do that fast. I wanted to feel better. Fast, you know what I mean? And that's what booze did to me. It did it fast, you know, it did it fast. And one of the things that, one of the things I remember as far as this disease is concerned, which sort of followed me all my life now that I think about it, is when I was about, one of the things that happens when you have this feeling of inadequacy deep down inside or fear of people is you never really think that you particularly are good enough. In other words, you say things like, you know, I need a car. And when you say I need a car, you mean I need a car to get a gal, to do this. Because without a car, I need a car in order to do that. Or you need alcoholics always need things. I need that. I need to get that blouse. I need to get this. I need to have that. Listen, I bought more crap in my life with money I didn't have, things I didn't need, with money I didn't even have to impress people I didn't even like, than you can possibly imagine. I've charged up credit cards going out buying shit to make myself feel better, to make myself feel okay, because right here, right now, I'm not okay, and I've gone out and I've spent money and then gone to meetings and complained about not having money. I've made a lot of money, and by the way, you know what I learned when I was 10 years sober? I learned if you spend more money than you make, you go into something called debt. Did you know that? I didn't know that. I couldn't understand that. Why my secretary had more savings than I did. I went to my sponsor once when I was 10 years sober, and I was telling about all my money problems, and he said, "Well, I can solve that for you." I said, "You could solve it, you know?" He says, "Yeah, absolutely, I can solve that." And he said, "Well, how do you solve it?" He says, "Now listen," he says, "this is how you solve it. Earn more or spend less." I said, "Well, what's option three?" You know, I wanted the third option. Because I needed to spend money on a lifestyle that I didn't deserve. Because without that lifestyle, I was a nothing. Because you just have this opinion about yourself that you need a lot of stuff, a lot of accoutrements, you know, a lot of things in your life, you know, to be almost acceptable because you're so unacceptable. You know, you walk into that bar and you're looking at those people. Will they like you? Will they not like you? Will you blend? Will you not blend? You take a couple of drinks. How's the group going to feel? Are you going to be able to join the group? Are you going to belong to the group? Because if you're an alcoholic, you're a resentaholic. You're a please love me-aholic. You know, Marlon Brando said, if I go to a party and there's 300 people and one doesn't like me, I got to leave. I can't handle the fact that one person may not like me. It just drives me crazy. You know, I'm worried about whether the group accepts me. I take two drinks. I think I own the fucking group. I think I own them. You know what I mean? That's what alcohol did for me. When I was about 18 years old, 19 years old, I inherited a few bucks. You know, not a lot of bucks back then. It was like in the 1970s, 1970, 1971. The new Camaro, and the booze hadn't really started working on me. I suppose I was like alcohol. I was drinking. But you know, it hadn't started getting me in trouble. And the bottom line is that the new Camaros had come down. And back then, and I can't explain it to you, they were absolutely hot. They were incredible. You know what I mean? And every time they had a Camaro on TV, there'd be a good-looking blonde next to it. And I knew if I could get one of them Camaros, I'd get one of them bunny things. You know what I mean? Because I had to have a Camaro to get the bunny thing. You know what I mean? And I was just dying to get that. And I ran down. I got the first Camaro in Dade County. I was like 19, 20 years old. I ran down to the Chevrolet dealer on Alton Road. And I plunked down the money on that thing. And I owed about, I financed it for a bunch of times, you know. But I plunked it down. And it was a Friday. And I said, okay, give it to me. He says, we can't give it to you. I said, what do you mean you can't give it to me? He says, we got to prep it. They had to do something like, I paid about $200-$300 to prep it. It was part of the deal. He says, no, you can give it to me because I'm an alcoholic. I want it now. He says, no, you don't, it's the law. We can't give it to you until we prep it. But if you show up tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, we're going to give you that car. And so I was there at like 8 o'clock waiting for that car, you know, because I knew that my life, this would totally change my life. Everything would be different. You ever have that deal? He says, now everything's going to be okay. Now everything's going to be perfect. Now that I moved to Towson, everything's going to be, now that I'm going to college, now that I got a degree, now that I got a job, now that I got some, now everything's going to be okay, and then it all turns to shit. You know what I mean? It's always, you know, I was always that if but, a yes butter and an if only. If only this, yes but that, you don't understand. I was a you don't understander, a yes butter, an if onlyer. It was always going to hell, and I didn't know why. And I put down the money. I showed up there on Saturday at 8 o'clock in the morning. The car came out at 9 o'clock. I jumped in the car. It had about 150 miles on it. It had that new car smell. It was gorgeous. It was a gold exterior. It sounds kind of cheesy now, but back then it had a gold exterior with a white Landau roof. That's like a vinyl roof. Sounds cheesy now, but a vinyl roof. And it was like sleek and it was cool. And I jumped in that car. I was smoking at the time. You know, I had the cigarette in my mouth. I had the sunglasses on. It was about 100 pounds lighter. I had my T-shirt rolled up with like, you know, that kind of deal, and had my hand out the window. I'm driving along Alton Road. I pull out on Alton Road in this brand new car, and I'm thinking to myself, I had this feeling. It's like being drunk. I was like being drunk. You know, let me tell you something. Booze isn't the only thing that can get you. You can get drunk off of self-pity. You can get drunk off of buying shit. You can get drunk off of walking to a bar with a good-looking blonde on your arm. You can get drunk on a lot of things. A lot of things. Believe me, booze is not the only stuff that you can get drunk on. You know, anything that makes me feel good sometimes can make me get drunk. I can get drunk on that stuff. And I'm driving down Alton Road, and I swear there was nobody on the road. I thought I was driving in Yankee Stadium. I thought every woman in China was looking at me. I thought, you know, I'm saying, I'm just waiting for them to discover me, to look at me, to see me in that car, because I knew my life had changed. I knew everything was going to be perfect. I stopped at the first light 3 blocks down the road. Some guy pulls up in a brand new Cadillac right next to me. I ride some old fart like me now. You know what I mean? You know, some guy, he's in his 60s. You know, he's sitting there, you know, silver hair. He pulls up in a brand new Cadillac. He's to my right. I'm to his left. I'm sort of low to the ground in this long car. He's sort of up there. So I'm looking up at him. He's looking down at me. I'm looking up at him. He's looking down at me. I'm looking over at him, he's looking down at me. I look over at him, sitting next to him is the Playboy Bunny. All of a sudden this thought goes through my mind. Why can't I have a car like that? Let me tell you something, the feeling lasted 3 blocks, the payments lasted 36 months. That's my entire life. My entire life is getting married. You know, my chance of staying married to anybody or staying permanent with everybody, because, you know, everything has a half-life of 5 minutes with me. It's wonderful for 5 minutes, for 5 weeks, for 5 months, and then I made a mistake. We really don't belong together. Adios, muchacho. You know what I mean? When I got married to a wonderful young lady, very nice young lady, you know, just from a wonderful family, great gal and non-alcoholic, you know, nothing wrong with her. You know what I mean? And we got married, and they put on a big shindig, and I started working for the state's attorney's office as a division chief over there and trying murder cases in Miami-Dade, and you don't get much headier than that if you're a young egomaniac alcoholic, and getting my name in the paper and things like that, that kind of stuff. And I don't know what it was. You know, I liked hanging out in the bars. I liked hanging out in the bars because they were the only – my wife would say – I'd invite my wife. I'd say – why don't you come? You can come to the bar with me. I says, I don't want to hang out with those bums. I said, bums? These guys are the great. These are the guys. These are the only people that understand me. the only people that understand me. And I'd hang out at those bars, and I never cheated on my wife. I just thought about it a lot. You know, I just put myself in the bar, looking at the gals, saying, look at these guys, they're having so much fun. You know, why can't I have fun like that? You know, I'm married, I got to go home and everything. And I just thought about it a lot, you know. And she was starting to look like that Camaro after you saw the Cadillac. You know, it was that kind of thing, because I was already resting, already looking. And one day I used to come home at 3 o'clock. And, you know, I don't know what it was. I used to come home. You know, one time she said to me, she said this. It was a Friday. She said these words to me. I came out. We had a beautiful son. You know, three-year-old son, absolutely gorgeous. Lived in a beautiful house in Miami Beach. It was on the golf course. I had everything you could possibly imagine to have the perfect life. The things that I thought would make me perfect, and I was just not happy. I was not happy. And I used to come in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know, she had, unfortunately, she had something called self-esteem. She apparently didn't like the fact that she was married to somebody that wouldn't show up for dinner or stuff like that. And she said to me these words. I walked out one morning, and she said, I just want you to know. It was like she didn't start an argument. It's like she was delivering the mail. She said, I just want you to know, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. That's what she said. She just sort of, you know, just want you to know, you come home drunk one more time. I'm sitting there in my pinstripe suit, blue suit with a white shirt and the red tie and ready to go over to the state's attorney's office, the Metro Justice Building. She says, I just want you to know, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. 12 words. You come home drunk one more time, I am leaving you. It's actually 12, somewhere in there. But in any event, so I get in my car and I drive down the street. I get to the first light. You know, alcoholics are like idiot savants. We can be brilliant in all sorts of areas, but in some areas we're just dumb. We're just dumb. We just don't see it. Because you don't see what you want to see. Yeah, you don't see what you don't want to see. I mean, the first step in getting out of jail is you got to know you're in jail in the first place. If you don't know you're in jail and you don't see it, there's a whole bunch of crap you can miss in AA and the Big Book and all sorts of stuff because you just don't want to see it. You say things like, well, it can't possibly mean that. You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. There's no fat in that statement. That's not complicated. You know what I mean? That's not complicated. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. Everything that's important to me or should have been important to me was right up there in the line. She said, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I get to my first light. This is what I say. And I'm as sober then as I am right now. I wasn't drinking. This is what I say to myself. What the hell did she mean by that? I'm trying to figure out what is she talking about? What does she mean by that? That's what alcoholics do. You know, the judge looks at him and says things like, I see you one more time, I'm putting you under the jail. The alcoholics walk out and say, what the hell was that all about? You know, I mean, it's just like we're blank. Absolutely crazy. Because we're driven. We're driven to do crazy things. We don't even know why we do. We're confused. You know, the guy says, leave or I'm calling the cops. You say, call the cops. The cops come. That's what we say. We say, call the cops. We send the email. We do this stuff. 6 months later, we're in jail. The guy says to us, he says, why'd you say that? And we say something like, I don't know. It seemed like the right thing because we're driven. We're driven. We think we got free will. We're free. We just do shit. We say crap. We do things that are self-destruct. We quit jobs. We do crazy things. Put ourselves in a jam. Do absolutely insane things. And then 3 months down the road, why'd you do that? I don't know. You can't live a life when you walk around, you're a thinking human being and do stupid things and hurt people. And then when you're asked, why'd you do it? Say, I don't know. And you know what the sad news is? We have no idea. We don't know. We don't know. We do it because we can't help but doing it. Because not only can't we help drink, we can't. Not only can't we stop drinking, we can't stop thinking, we can't stop talking, we can't stop saying that shit, we can't stop doing stupid stuff. We can't stop because we're driven by some sort of selfishness that's deep down inside, much deeper than the alcohol deal, which causes us to say and do stupid, crazy things. And that's where the real disease. That's the thing I've been dealing with for 35 years. I'm going to tell you a little bit about something that happened to me about a month ago, 2 months ago. It gives you an idea of how this thing really gets. Because when you get sober, the alcoholism doesn't come at you in the form of a bottle. You know? It doesn't even come at, well, at first it may come at you, and my sponsor used to say underneath every skirt is a slip. It doesn't come at you. It comes at you from behind trees, from behind rocks, and places you can't even imagine where it comes at you from. So she said, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I went into work. I heard the words. I went to my bar. my bar, you know, I had a bar, it was my bar, you know, because I was there all the time. You know, the kind of thing, you walk in there, if they change the seating arrangements, you're pissed off, they should have consulted you, you know what I mean? I walked to my bar, sat next to my drinking buddy, Doug, and I told him, I remember I repeated it to him, I said, Doug, I cannot stay, because Ronnie says, if I come home drunk one time, she's leaving me. He put his arm around me, and he said, you know, drinking buddies, they're the greatest. He says, Russ, she's never gonna leave you. She says she loves you. You're the greatest guy in the world. I start thinking, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That's why I love this fucking guy. You know what I mean? These guys are so sharp, you know? But he said, no. And it's 5:30. It's 5:30. You understand what I'm saying? No, it's 5:30. And I'm 15 minutes away from home. So I figured it was okay to have a drink. So I had one drink. So I said, give me a double scotch. So I didn't realize until 5 years later, I was always already on two drinks. So give me a double scotch. And that's why I drank. I drank it neat without water. And I went like this again, whack. And, you know, now I'm feeling a little bit better. And now it's 5:30 and 30 seconds later. And it seemed like it was okay to have another drink. So I had another drink. And now it's 5:30 and 1 minute later. And another drink. And the next thing I know, I remember John Kamarowski was talking about lizards or something, and there was some gal there, and the next thing I know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and they're driving me home and pouring me out on the living room. And the next day, my marriage was over. I was kicked out of the house. The next day, my marriage was over. I was kicked out of the house. And as I'm being kicked out, you know what I'm saying to myself? This is what I'm saying. I'm saying, I'm free. I'm free. I'm walking away from this beautiful house, this beautiful wife, this beautiful child, this beautiful life. And I'm saying I'm free. Free to go and stay in the bar. You listen, I was never free not to do that. I was compelled to. I was never free to be married to anybody for a long period of time. I was never free to have any type of decent relationship with anybody. Because I was not free. Because I was driven to hurt and kill and just assassinate people in relationships without even knowing it. There's nothing or nobody in my life that could come into my life that could stay and make me feel okay. No person, place, or thing. Although that's what I chased, and that's what you chase, and that's what we still chase once we get in there, thinking that some person will do it for it, some place, some thing, some car, some money, and that will do it. Never, and absolutely believing one of these old ideas that it's the shit, that the stuff that will do it for us. And always wanting that stuff and whining over not having it and being ticked off when we don't get it and worrying about what happens if we lose it and never understanding that it will never fix us and being totally confused until we get rid of that old idea. And that's an old idea that's hard to get rid of because it seems so clear that $1 million would solve this. It would really solve this thing. And there's a lot of movie stars out there that got millions of dollars and fame and all this stuff and they're putting heroin up their arms and they're dying. You read about them all the time. So if fame and that stuff would solve this thing, you know, believe me, you'd see it. It doesn't work that way. It destroys you. And so I came home, and that was the end of a five-year marriage. And I didn't even realize that booze was the problem. It wasn't until 5 years later when I was 6 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor was telling me about his marriage and how it broke up. I said, that's how my, you know, if you would ask me why I'm getting divorced, I said we were different people. She didn't understand me. It was a big mistake. And I would have said all that stuff and believed it. And, you know, the truth of the matter is this is why my marriage didn't last. She said, if you come home drunk one time, I'll leave you. And I came home drunk. It was all about the alcohol. You know, the only other thing I'm going to say about that is about a month after I left the house, my wife thought, you know, we had a son and everything like that. She was going to try to get together and try to make it work, you know, because she was one of these gals that believed in, like, vows. You know, vows, whatever those are. You know what I mean? And, you know, like love, honor, and obey till death do us part and all that crap, you know? And the bottom line is so we said, let's go to tribe. We'll go to a marriage. She wanted to go to a marriage counselor. And so I went to a marriage counselor, not because I wanted to get back together, but because if you're an alcoholic, you just eat off and you live on guilt. And, you know, she had great parents and she was a good gal. And how could I say no? I mean, it was like I felt trapped, like I had to go. You ever see the movie Godfather 3? Where Al Pacino said I was out and they dragged me back in. I'm sitting there with a marriage counselor. She's sitting there on this side. I'm sitting on this side. I'm already hanging out in the bars. I'm already scoping out the girls. I'm already ready to become the Hugh Hefner of Miami. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting there and she's there and I'm here and the marriage counselor's there and he's asking questions. And I'm saying, this is not good. They're about to put me back in the cage. And he says to her, I guess they teach this in marriage counseling school. He says, well, let me ask something. What are the three things you want to change about Russell? And he says, well, I want him to come home for dinner, show up for dinner sometime, maybe stop drinking, you know. Whatever he said about three things, I wasn't paying attention. So, and he says, so she says, so then he turns to me and says, well, Russell, what are the, because I'm saying, this is not good. He says, what are the three things you want to change about Ronnie? And I said, I just want to date other women. That was the end of the marriage counseling session. You know, that's a little stupid story, you know what I mean? You know, I'm going to tell you something. This is the truth. You may not believe this. It wasn't until I was 10 years sober that I did all the steps and I did amends and everything, but it wasn't until I was 10 years sober that I remembered doing that. And at 10 years I was ready to actually think about that and what that must have done to my wife. You know, I was a nice guy. I was an asshole. You know, I tell myself, well, at least I'm not Adolf Hitler. I'm basically a good guy. I mean, I didn't kill 6 million people. I mean, there was Adolf Hitler down here and Jesus Christ up here. And I figure I'm like in the upper third. You know what I mean? Because I had a three-piece suit and I was an asshole. I wouldn't think twice about running over people or hurting people to get my own way. You know, when you live a life like that, the life of a bum, irresponsible, you don't give a shit about other people. You know what I mean? You have those voices in the shower saying you're a piece of shit. You ought to kill yourself. You have those voices because you have a constitutional capacity to be honest. You know who you really are. You know what the deal is. That never leaves you. I went into, I have this sponsor. I'm going to tell you a couple of sponsor stories. Then I'm going to, we're almost done, but I'm going to put in a little bit extra, a little 15 minutes or so and try to give you a little bit more on sobriety. Got a sponsor. I got a mean and cruel sponsor. I was supposed to get Albert Einstein or Jesus Christ. They weren't available, so they gave me some guy who was didn't even graduate grade school. He was a used car salesman named Bob Sullivan. I've had three sponsors because, you know, they're all temporary. They die on you. They were all great guys, and they all had a lot of time. They taught me a lot, and I've learned a lot from the men in my life, and they were wonderful, wonderful men. I have a great sponsor now, and tell you a little bit about Bob Sullivan. I remember one time he said to me, I asked him to be my sponsor. He said, look, here's the deal. He says, I want you to join a home group. I want you to, I said, if you ever think about drinking, and I want you to read the 24-hour book every single day and ask God's help to stay sober. I don't remember him asking me whether I believed in God. That wasn't part of the deal. He said, just do it. And the next thing I heard him say is, if you ever feel like drinking, I want you to call me up before you, don't call me up after you drink, call me up before you drink. I remember one time I was about three months sober, and my fiance, who's my wife now, you know, she did something. My wife, she's a member of Al-Anon, Our Ladies of Perpetual Revenge, you know what I mean? She's actually down here. She wasn't feeling well tonight, or else she would have been here, so, which is probably good because I can talk this way, you know what I mean? But she doesn't like it, but let me tell you something. She knows how to do an Al-Anon 10-step. When I'm wrong, she promptly admits it, you know? I have this little granddaughter named Andrea. I have four granddaughters and two grandsons, but I have this little granddaughter named Andrea. All my grandkids are cute as buttons, but this one's really cute. And she's about, you know, 5 years old. We were at my house. I was in my home office and I was typing away and she was in the kitchen with grandma, you know, the Al-Anon gal. And she comes up and she says, Grandpa. I said, what, Andrea? She says, Grandpa, what kind of fish are you? I said, I'm sorry, what, Andrea? She says, what kind of fish are you? I said, what kind of fish am I? He says, yeah, what kind of fish are you? I said, I don't know, Andrea. What kind of fish am I? He says, you're a selfish. I said, you've been talking to Grandma, haven't you? You know? And Yeah, that's my list. So the bottom line is, so my sponsor comes in. So he says, if you ever going to drink, so the gal was supposed to be my future wife, my wife now. She did, you know how they are. You know, she said some, you know, said some sort of bull. You know, when you're newly sober, you're kind of. I used to tell my sponsor, I said, I'm sensitive. He says, no, great artist is sensitive. You're just touchy. She said something to me like, you know how they. This is what they all wives say this. They all say the same exact thing. You haven't changed at all. And then you just go nuts because you know how incredibly magnificent she doesn't understand. She doesn't see all the stuff you're doing. She doesn't, you know, and I'm going to. And I said, and so I decided in my mind is saying, I said, I'll show her. I'm going to drink. And then she'll see how I'll show her. I'll drink. And then she'll be sorry. And so, but before I drank, I picked the phone. I called my sponsor and it was ring. Nobody. I called me. Ring. Nobody answered. Call me again. Ring, and nobody answered. Then I call him again. Busy signal. I said, holy crap, this is bullshit. He told me it's unbelievable. The next day I said to him, I said, you know, you told me if I was ever going to drink to call you. You know, when I called you and it rang, and I called you and it rang, and I called you and it rang, and I called you and it was busy, and you didn't even answer the phone anytime. And I was going to drink. And he said, Well, did you drink? I said, no, I didn't drink. He says, you see, it works. He can't talk to these guys. He was in my office once. I graduated Department of Honors in Mathematics, National Science Foundation Fellow, lawyer. I have a wall full of diplomas and degrees that prove that I've been educated far beyond my capacity to understand anything. And he's in my office once, and he's sitting in front of me, and he says, I said, Bob, these are all my degrees. And he says, well, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. These are the kind of people that I sponsored, you know what I mean? And I'm going to tell you, you know, I could tell you a lot of stories about sobriety, because what I want to talk to you about is sobriety. I'm going to tell you two stories. You know, when you've been sober, imagine this. You've been sober for 35 years. 35 years of doing this crap. Can you imagine how many stories? You know what it says? Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like. Do you know, every day is another story. Every hour there's another story. You know how many stories I have about the miracle of this deal? You know how many stories I have about being rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, experiencing much of heaven? You know, the central fact of our lives, being God is working in our hearts and miraculously working. You know how many stories I got about, you know, story? I mean, I could sit here for 6 hours and tell you stories. You know, and to be here for like 45 minutes or an hour and just sort of pick two or three and stuff like that. But that's the way it is. But I want to tell you a couple of stories. You know, one story that I like to tell, you know, I think the truth is in all our stories. You know, it says absolutely you can believe what these people say about themselves because there's some sort of truth in the stories. Sometimes you'll see one truth in a particular story and 10 years later you'll think about it and you'll see another truth there. There's all sorts of different layers. When I was 3 months sober, my sponsor brought me to a meeting. I was very blessed by associating with older members, I guess you'd call them old timers, of Alcoholics Anonymous. Big book thumpers, guys like that. They're around. If you look at them, you know, there's a lot of people that run away from them. You know what I mean? Because they make them uncomfortable. Because if they hang with them, they may have to change. But I was attracted to them. I don't know what it was that attracted me to them, but I was attracted to these guys. And once you latch on to one old timer, they seem to hang on to others. You meet others. For many years, I thought this was sort of like, this whole thing worked like sort of osmosis. If you just hung out with Joe Snyder, if you just hung out with Bob Sullivan, if you just hang out with these guys, somehow just listening to them and how they talk and how they think, it would like come upon you. And I still think that's important, but ultimately I learned that you have to actually do something. You have to do the steps. It's not just but the truth is I've done the steps many times. My life has become the steps. You know, when you first start out, you see the steps everywhere. Oh, I just did a third step. Oh, that was a tenth step. Oh, that was a seventh step. Oh, that was a sixth step. Now you just live your flipping life. You know what I mean? Your whole life, you become the book. You become that deal. But I hung around. But now I know that the statement is true. The man and woman you'll become in the next 5 years will depend upon the people you hang out with and the books you read. And the books you read will depend upon who you hang out with. How you think will depend on who you hang out with. You know, I mean, if you hang out with the guys in parking lots, smoking and talking about getting laid and shit like that, that's what your life is. That's what you'll become. That's what you'll be thinking with, especially alcoholics, because there's an old line, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious, and if true happiness, he'll find none at all. And one of the consequences of being an alcoholic is, even though you think you're a leader, we are incredibly affected by the people around us. Man, when I was in Manhattan, I was drinking scotch. And when I was in Key West, I was drinking margaritas. When I'm in a country and western bar, you know, I'm drinking beer. You know, if I'm at some pot party, I'm smoking. But I'm doing whatever the people are doing around me in order to blend. I am affected tremendously by the folks I gather around me. And I'm the one who chooses who to hang out with. And I hung out with these men. And Bob Sullivan took me to a meeting once where there was a man. And, you know, this is funny. I was 3 months sober in this house. 3 months sober, and it was like yesterday. And there was a guy speaking named Al Kennedy. And he was doing we have things called step meetings in Dade County, and I do step series. And what happens is you take one guy who's been around for a long time, and we do 12 weeks of talking about, you know, I do these all the time. I got a lot of the 12 weeks of, that's what I'm used to doing, talking about the steps over a 3 month period at a particular group. And he was doing a meeting. This guy Al Kennedy was doing. I'd never seen him before. And he probably had about 35 years at the time. And he was like one of these guys. Like, I was sitting there in the front row, like Jesse sitting right there. And I was like transfixed. I was like watching him. I was watching him because what he was talking about, the stuff he was talking about, was like, I mean, I was just focused on him. It was just something about him. I was just learning so much and seeing so much. And, you know, it was like one of these things. Man, if I could only hang out with this guy. You know, I got to hang out with this guy. Where can I hang out? This guy is unbelievable. And he finished and he left. And I'm sitting next to my sponsor. And I say to my sponsor, I say, boy, that guy was great. I said, I'd like to see him again. I'd like to hang out. You know anything about him? And this is what my sponsor says. He said, well, he's dying. He's dying. My sponsor used to say crazy stuff like that. You know what I mean? Because sponsors, you know, old-timers, they're crazy. They think stupid. One time I went up to my sponsor. I was 3 months sober, and I was broke, and I had no money. I had a wife, and I had a couple of kids, and we were about to be, and I thought I was going to be foreclosed on because I didn't have any money. I was behind the rent and all sorts of money because I spent all this money on shit that I didn't, you know. And I went up to him and I was telling him about all my problems, you know, and I had big problems, major problems, just like, not like your bullshit problems. I had major shit, you know what I mean? And I went up to my sponsor and he was making coffee with the group before the meeting, the Friday night meeting. And I told him about my major problems. And he said to me, after I told him about the problem, the money problem, which, I mean, I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't sleep. I was driving. I told him about the problem. And this is what he said to me. He said, you know, Russ, I think it's about time you started making coffee for the group. I'm about to die. I'm about to be kicked out of the street. We're going to live on the street. He says, I think it's about time you start making coffee. It was like there was no conversation. I sensed there was like no conversation going on. But, you know, I was 3 months sober, and I somehow knew back that more than anything, I didn't want to drink. And I knew that the not drinking had something to do with him. And, you know, I was vulnerable. I mean, I walked in there. I had two neurons working. They were waving goodbye to each other. You know what I mean? And so, you know, what happens? I start making coffee for the group. You know what I mean? And I mean, there would be days that I didn't want to go to the meeting, but I had to make the freaking coffee for the group. And I had to go to the meeting and make the coffee. And after 3 or 4 months, some guy came up to me and says, I'll make the coffee. I said, that's my job. I'm the coffee maker of this group, you know what I mean? I made it for 18 months, I couldn't give it away. But he was used to saying, I would say something to him, and he would say something stupid, like, make the coffee. And I, you know, I was thinking in my mind, well, this is how he gets out of making the coffee, you know? And he would, so I went up and I said, Al Kennedy, I said, that guy was great. And he says, well, you know, well, he's dying. And I thought he didn't hear me. I said, no, the speaker, the guy who just spoke, he said he was great. And he said, yeah, but he's dying. I said, what? He's dying. I'm talking about the guy who's just speaking. He said, he's dying. He's got terminal cancer. He's got 3 or 4 months to live. I was there. You don't make this shit up. You know what I mean? You don't make this crap up. You know, I mean, I'm used to going to discussion meetings where people are, you know, talking about hangnails and shit. You know what I mean? And, you know, I can't find my cell phone. What the hell they're talking about? And he says, Russell, he's got terminal cancer. He's got 3 months to live. And I said, he didn't say anything about that. He was just trying to help people and talking to people, and you know, he didn't say anything about that, and he was talking about how grateful he is to God and to be alive and to be sober. He was just saying, I said, and he said, I said, I know Russ. He says, but he died of cancer, you know. And 4 months later, Al Kennedy was dead. He died. Now, I got to tell you this. If you asked me right now, I can't remember one thing that Al Kennedy said. I can't remember one thing that Al Kennedy said. The only thing I remember is some guy came to speak one night. He was incredible. He helped hundreds of people. He spent time with people trying to love on them and help them. And the only thing I remember is the guy was dying. He didn't say a word. He didn't say anything about it. He didn't complain. He was happy. He was excited. And he left. That's the only thing. You wanted something? I've never forgotten that. It completely changed my vision of what sobriety was, what a sober person, what sobriety really was. And believe me, it's more than just not drinking. It's more than just not drinking. It's a different deal. So I'm going to tell you one last story, because this is a story that just happened about 4 months ago. And I think this has to do with that. You know, we never get cured of this deal. It's always around us. It doesn't matter whether you have 35 years, 40 years, whatever it is. So I want to tell you a little story about what happened to me. You always got to be on guard. You always have to have, man, it's so important for me. I probably go to more meetings now than I've ever gone before. I hang around with my sponsor. I don't even know how much he has, like 58 years or something like that now. And he's a great guy, and they do a lot of things. But I'm going to tell you this little story. My wife was having her, I don't know what birthday, I think she told me it was her 45th birthday. My wife is, this is her 20th 45th birthday. She used to be 40, but what happened was she has been 40 for 20 years. And she told me this last year, this last August, that she was going to be 45. So it was my wife's 45th birthday. And I asked her what she wanted to do for her birthday. And she said, well, I want to go out to a restaurant with the kids. And I said, okay, well, why don't you pick the restaurant you want to go? And she picked the restaurant, you know, one of the most expensive restaurants in Miami, of course, you know. And you know, the Lord has blessed me in a situation so that I can afford to do it. I mean, I'm not wealthy, you know what I mean? But I can afford to take my kids. But, you know, you got to understand, when you're going out to a restaurant and it's like, you know, 30, 40 bucks a person. And I've got like three kids, not four kids. One of my kids is up here, three kids. And I got four grandchildren, and I got my son-in-law and everything. You know, when I go out, it's like the 101st Airborne. It's like, you know, 15, it's like 15 people going out. You know what I'm talking about? So even though, you know, I can do it and I got the money, you know, I'm thinking in my mind, you know, and I'm thinking in my mind, you know, I mean, I got to be honest with you, the calculator's going, you know what I mean? I'm saying, okay, this is going to cost me, you know, I don't know, 500, 600, whatever the heck it's going to cost me, it's going to cost me some money. So we all go to the restaurant. There's myself, there's my three daughters, and there's my son-in-laws and my grandkids, and we're in the restaurant, and they're just ordering up a storm. And I mean, the five-year-old saying things like, Andre's saying things, Mommy, can I have a shrimp cocktail? Sure, Grandpa will pay for it, you know what I mean? Yeah, bring another, they're not alcoholics. Yeah, bring another bottle. Yeah, can we have another, let me see the wine list, you know what I mean? And I'm going, I got to tell you something, I'm on the outside, I'm acting calm, you understand what I'm saying? But I got to admit to you, the calculator is fucking going. You know what I mean? You know, he's going, oh, there's another $100 with a bottle of wine. There's another, you know, have you ever noticed how much they charge me? You know, my drinks, bring me another dirty martini. You know, I said, oh, that's another 15, you know. And I'm going in my mind, I'm adding this up. I'm saying, you know, I got the plastic. I'm okay. It's okay, but that's the deal. And it's okay. And everybody's having a great time, okay? And the thing is over. And everybody's done their thing, and I signed the bill, and, you know, the gross national product, you know, and everybody is happy. Happy. And I walk out the door, and I'm driving home with my wife, and I'm driving home with one of my daughters, Vanessa. Now, I'm not going to go into Vanessa's story, because she might listen to this, but the bottom line is, but Vanessa's an interesting gal. She's a middle child, and she's very strong-willed. But in any event, as we're driving home, I say to my wife, I mentioned to my wife, I said, you know, we're out of coffee. I really need to get coffee. Because I am a coffeeaholic. You know, I'm really a coffeeaholic. It's true, you know. And I'm the kind of guy, I drink three cups of coffee before I go to sleep so it'll calm me down, you know. And I don't know what that's all about. It's like Ritalin or something. But anyway, my daughter says, well, Dad, pull up next to Publix. I don't know whether you have Publix here. It's a big shop. He says, and I'll go and get your coffee. So I pull up to Publix, and I said, now listen, Vanessa, this is important. You know, I only drink Folgers Colombian coffee. I said, you got to understand, when you go into the grocery store, you see Folgers and you see the Colombian coffee. I want you to explain this to you. They have different blends. They have like breakfast blend and you're full of shit blend. And, you know, you don't know what you're doing. Yeah, they got all these blends. And the wheat ones, it goes from yellow. They have an arrow that points from yellow, which is like water. You know what I mean? To dark black, which is like you drink this, you die, you know, that kind of stuff. I said, it's Colombian blend. It's the dark blacks. That's the stuff I drink, the Colombian blend. She says, okay, Dad. So I pull up and I said, now remember, it's the Colombian blend, the dark black stuff. And she says, Dad, this is what she says, Dad, stop it. I'm not an idiot. You say it one more time, I'm not going to get you anything, okay? I understand it. Folgers Colombian blend, okay? That's it. Don't say another word. You know, that's okay. She gets out. You know, 5 seconds later, she's in. She throws the plastic bag in. She says, I got it. We're okay. I said, great. I drive. I drop her off. I get back to the house. It's like 10:30 at night now, okay? And I take the thing out of the thing, and it's the breakfast shit. It's the yellow shit. It's the weakest one. I am flipping out. You know, I mean, it's not even, it is a fact of the coffee, but it isn't even the coffee. It's like the principle. It's like, what, did she do this on purpose? I mean, what's even worse, it was after she said, what am I, stupid? Don't say it again. You know, that kind of thing. You know, it's almost like she said, you know, screw you. I'll do it on purpose. Look, it's not that I give a crap about, I mean, I'm happy to help. It's not that I'm selfish or anything, or I care about, you know, but I just spent like $700 at dinner. I didn't ask for one blessed thing. You know, the only thing I asked for is get me the flipping coffee. You know what I mean? Get me the flipping coffee. And she went out and she got this. And so the next thought I have in my mind is, I'm calling her up. I'm calling her up because let me tell you why I'm calling. No, this is the truth. Because she deserves it because of the flippant attitude she had. Because, first of all, she cannot be, first of all, it's like the universe is askew. It's like somebody has set the universe. I mean, it's not right. You know, it's wrong. She was wrong. I mean, she's alky wrong. You know, if you don't agree with me, you got to die because you're so stupid. What she did was wrong. And she can't be allowed to get away with it. No, she can't be allowed to get away with it. And it's not that I'm going to say it, but I mean, she's got to know what she did. You know what I mean? And that I caught in what she did, and I've got to tell her. And I, you know, I'm going to call her up, and I'm going to tell her. 10:30, and I said, let me tell you something. Let me tell you what you did. I asked you two times, you time, and I'm going to tell her the deal, because that's what's going to happen, because it's right and true, and she was wrong, and she, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I've been doing this thing for a long time, going to a lot of meetings. I started thinking about that, about calling her up and telling her about how she screwed up. And you got to understand Vanessa, my daughter. She's tough on the outside, but she's like real sensitive on the inside. And I know that what she would hear me say, whatever I said to her, however I said it, what she would hear me say is, I think you're a flippin' loser. That's what she would hear me say. I hate you and you're a loser. I don't care how I say it, that's what she would hear. And women don't need men to tell them that they're losers. They don't need their fathers to tell them that they're losers. You understand what I'm saying? What they need is they need men to build them up. You understand? That's what children need. That's what other people need. They need men to build them up, not selfish, self-centered assholes that go out and hurt people and are cruel to people because all they do is think about themselves. So, whatever, I decided to drink this shit and not call her. And no big deal. And to this day, as far as I know, she doesn't even know about it, and nor would I tell her about it. To me, it's just a story in AA. It's just an AA story about restraint of tongue. It's actually 10-step stuff about restraint of tongue. It's about, now, it's about the spiritual transformation that happens in this program if you just give yourself over to God. Because, believe me, I could not. There's not enough books I could read. I don't have the, where I could have changed myself that way. There's not enough psychiatrists I could have gone to. Just like with Roland Hazard, you know, now knowing the inner workings of my mind. There's not enough, I had all the brains. I had all the intelligence. All my intelligence allowed me to do, armed with that intelligence, is tell me that it was okay to call her up and tell her that shit. I would rationalize it, you know what I mean? I would hurt people, and I would tell myself that I was right. You know, and you can either be right or happy, and I decided a long time ago I'd rather be happy. Make other people happy. Help other people. And the only thing that's changed me is faith in God. You know, that's it. And the faith, and I never had that before I came in here. You know, faith in God. That's the deal. That's what it's all about. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. You know, the people can't do it for you. You can't do it for yourself. You can't manage why only God could and would if you sought. See to it, your relationship with him is right. And great events will come and pass for you and countless others. You're not kind of, God either is or he isn't. What's your deal going to be? No, listen, you know. It says no moral thing is going to get you, no philosophical construct is going to get you. We got wrote a book where we have to talk about God. It's all about that deal. It's all about that deal. So, you know, that's just an example of some of the things that happen. Even it doesn't matter how many years you have, how your mind, how things can happen, stuff can happen to you where the craziness has nothing to do with the drinking. Where the craziness can take over and cause you. And I know men and women that haven't spoken to their children or brothers or sisters or fathers and mothers in 20 years. And you ask why, it's because they picked up the phone and they said, you got the wrong frickin' coffee. I know people that have broken relationships with people in their lives because they couldn't help pick up the phone and saying, let me tell you what you did to me, because they couldn't shut their flipping mouth because they were thumb-sucking crybabies. I know that deal. That's alcoholism. I'm going to read you something. I'm going to end up by reading this last thing in the book. You know, it's funny. One of the things that happens to me in this book is all these books, all our literature. And I'm going to plead guilty to this. Is I'm a literature buff. I'm a big book guy. I'm a 12 and 12. I'm a Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. You know, that'll tell you a lot of stuff. You know, the books they found absolutely essential during the first 4 years, Sermon on the Mount, 1 Corinthians 13, and the Book of James. There's a lot of stuff in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. When they say rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, they said that in 1939. They were talking about the stuff they were doing before the Big Book was written. You got to read and see what they were doing before the Big Book was written. Let me tell you something. They were doing stuff that we're not doing today as far as surrender and things like that. There were a lot of stuff going on, you know, if you really want this deal. But in any event, sometimes what I'll do is I'll be whipping through the book. You know, they say when the pupil's ready, the teacher will appear. There's a lot of people that read this book, you know, and I'm not saying they don't read it. I've read it many, many times and underlined it. And they read it, but they miss like 90%, because, and that's normal. You read it, you pick out the things that are applicable. You know, when I first read this book, I was addicted to it. I couldn't put it down. You know, the only thing I saw in this book when I first read it, I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I saw this whole book about drinking. I swear to God, I read that thing on the jaywalker, on the drinking, on the resentments, and he couldn't stop drinking. I said, that's me. I didn't see anything else. All I said was, there's a book about a guy who drinks just like me and does the same stuff I do, and all I didn't see anything else. Now I read the book, and I see things about sobriety. I see things about that thing I just told you about, but I see other stuff that I never saw before. Because your brain itself, you read certain things, you don't read other things. You read things that make you feel good. You read things you agree with, and things you don't agree with, you toss it out. You know what I mean? It's like you didn't even see it. You know, but what happens is you go along in this deal, and as you grow and everything, all of a sudden things start popping. Let me tell you something. 3 o'clock in the morning, you're 15 years sober. You think your life is over. You have nothing else to do. You've tried everything. You open up the Big Book and you start reading something. You read a line you've read 10 times, and you say, holy shit, that's what they're talking about. You don't see it until your life catches up to the book, and all of a sudden you're experiencing it. So this happens to be one of these crazy things. I do a lot of, you know, sometimes people say to me, I get people that come up to me all the time, after meetings, during meetings, guys I sponsor, and they're having problems. They could have 20 years, 25, I sponsor guys with 25, 30 years, they got problems. And they want me to fix them. They want to know, you know, they want to know what's wrong with them or what they should do and stuff like that. And I always end up asking them basically the same questions because I'm lazy and it's simple for me to ask these questions. And 90% of the time, I'm right. You know, I pinpointed the deal. And I'll ask them a question like, how many meetings are you going to? And then the second question I'll ask them, I always ask them the same question. I said, how many people do you sponsor? So I'm interested in how many people I sponsor. And invariably, when I find somebody who's feeling sorry for themselves or having a problem and everything like that, they're not sponsoring anybody. Or if they're sponsoring 3 or 4 people, they don't really talk to them. They don't really sponsor them. It's like sponsoring name only or stuff like that. They're not doing the wet work. They're not, you know, a lot of stuff happens in here. They asked Bill Wilson, what do you think of alcoholics that don't drink and don't go to meetings? He says, I have no use for them because they have no gratitude. A lot of things, because we're alcoholics, remember, unless until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, sobriety will be precarious. One of the consequences of being an alcoholic is we're essentially lazy. I'm not talking about you guys, you know, I'm talking about me. I'm essentially, let me tell you something. If the remote control breaks in my house, I don't watch TV. I ain't getting up to change the channel or turn up the TV. I'm just lazy. And so when I start thinking about my feelings, which I'm an alcoholic, so what do I think about all the time? I think about me. All I want to do is think about me, you know? You know what I mean, Jesse? You know, let's talk about you, Jesse. What do you think about me? You know, I mean, it's all it is. It's me. You know what I want to think about? What's going to fix me? What's going to help me? When am I going to feel better? And you know what I think about when I start thinking about when am I going to feel better? I think about things like, you know, what book should I read? You know, what person should I hang out? What meeting should I go to? You know, what should I talk about at a discussion meeting? Who should I tell about this? I'm thinking about how I can fix me. That's all I think about. And, you know, that can work for a while with certain things. But after a while, you can do that for 10, 20 years before you even notice that you're not getting any better at all. At all. When the book says, it says, above everything, we must get rid of this selfishness. We must or it kills us. God makes that possible. And later on in the book, it says, the whole thing about God is he wants us, we have a job. The real idea, the real goal is to be of maximum service to ourselves and other people. And so it has been clear to me that the key is not worrying so much about when you're going to be better and what you're going to be better, because that's all part of the sickness. What the key is about helping other people. Losing concerns about your plans and designs and being concerned with other people. And I can tell you this, the last thing any alcoholic wants to hear, you know, when they're worried about money, is maybe it's time you should start making coffee for the group. That's the last thing they want to hear. That's the last thing that they think makes any sense based upon what they're talking about. Go help other people. Mother Teresa went around the slums of India and followed by a guy from New York Times. And then finally the guy in New York Times says, I wouldn't do what you're doing for $1 million. She said, neither would I. You know? And there's something about service that opens up the floodgate of the Holy Spirit and makes the transformation. Service to others. And the other day, and I talk about this all the time because I'm a big believer in it, because I see it works in my life and it works in others, and it's a tough sell. Because alcoholics always have good excuses like, well, nobody asked me to sponsor them. You know, I mean, I get that all. Nobody asked me. I said, what do they got to ask you? Go up to a newcomer and tell them you're their sponsor. They're stupid. They don't know. They don't know you're stupid. But I'm terrible. They don't know you're terrible. You know, they don't know. Just tell them. This is your life, you know. You know, but then here's the deal. It says, this is on page 14. I want to read this thing to you because I was reading it the other day. I said, man, there it's right there. It's right there in Bill's story. Right in Bill's story. In the first part of the book. The whole answer, the whole key. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating those principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And that's from the book of James, by the way. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and, you ready for this? Listen to this. Self-sacrifice for others. He could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. With us, it is just like that. Man, I'll tell you something. The last thing I want to hear about is self-sacrifice. You know, I'm sure I must have read that 1,000 times. And I never saw the word self-sacrifice. When was the last time you went to a discussion meeting where they said, let's talk about self-sacrifice? They don't want to talk about that. They want to talk about feeling happiness. They want to talk about resentment. They want to talk about relationships. They ain't talking about a relationship with God. They're talking about like sexual relationships, romantic relationships. Nobody's talking about self-sacrifice. Nobody's talking about, remember Al Kennedy? Remember Al Kennedy, the guy who was dying, who showed up at a meeting to try to help other people? And I was incredibly attracted to him, and he moved me. And I can't remember a word he said, but he changed my life. You know what he was doing? He was sacrificing himself. He was dying, and he was devoting his time and his effort and his love and his knowledge to try to help other people. Self-sacrifice. It's a rare thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a rare thing. Next time you're not feeling too well, and you're sort of worried about yourself, and you want to say, what can make me better, or what can I do, or what's wrong with me, why don't you do a little inventory about how many people you sponsor, how much service you're doing, how much you're trying to help other people. You know, I'm not pointing fingers at it. I'm pointing fingers at myself. It's a design for living, as Bill Wilson said, that works in rough going. So thank you very much for having me here, and God bless you. And once again, I congratulate you on your 4th anniversary.